The KGB was the main security agency for the Soviet Union. It emerged as a direct successor of preceding agencies such as the Cheka, GPU, OGPU, NKGB, NKVD, and MGB, and was nominally attached to the Council of Ministers. It was the chief government agency of carrying out internal security, foreign intelligence, counterintelligence, and secret police functions. Did it morph into the current FSB, or is the FSB a different kind of beast? Did any of the culture, traditions, and methods of the KGB pass to its descendant agency and operatives? What can we know for sure of this brutal and secretive organ of power, and what relation does it have to Putin and his kleptocratic regime? Welcome to the Silicon Curtain podcast. Please like, subscribe, and share the materials we produce. Welcome to the channel today, Dr. Yuri Felshtinsky, a prominent author, historian, and journalist, and expert on Russia and the former Soviet Union. He's appeared in print, TV, and radio interviews worldwide, and is widely known as the co-author of the book Blowing Up Russia with Alexander Litvinenko, a former lieutenant colonel in the FSB, who was infamously poisoned with radioactive polonium in London. His latest book, Blowing Up Ukraine, The Return of Russian Terror and the Threat of World War III, was researched before the invasion of Ukraine and is the first comprehensive investigation into the lethal methods Russia has used since 1999 to take over Ukraine, culminating in the full-blown and unprovoked invasion of this year. Yuri, welcome back to the channel.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start off with the FSB, because of course Vladimir Putin is intimately associated with that organization. What are the origins of it, and does it have its origins in the terroristic regime that took over Russia in 1917?
Well, yes, it does. Ironically, they're still in the same building. These are still the same people. All of them were working for KGB, you know, all their lives. Putin spent in KGB 20 years prior to the period when he became a politician and then president of Russia. But, you know, these are people who are trained by KGB. These are people who were selected for KGB initially. And they're really very different from the rest of us. That's why we have difficulties to understand what they are, what their intentions are. That's why it's very easy for them to deceive us, because when they talk to us, and then this relates to Putin talking to head of states, for example, they're not really talking to us, they are recruiting us. That's why it's very important for Putin to understand every time he's with somebody how to recruit this person, how to make it the way that his opponent will like him. And they're very good in finding witnesses. If you're a liberal, Putin will be liberal with you. If you're a nationalist, he would become nationalist with you. If you're a fascist, he would be fascist with you. And if you're a communist, he will be communist with you. And that's why he creates an impression that he's like everybody's friend, and until of course 2014 came first, and then 2022 came, until this was not about friendship or being liked anymore, or pretending that you are a Democrat or a liberal anymore, until they started to implement their political program. Now, the political program, and this is very important, has its roots in the idea of the world communism. And of course, in December of 1917, when the first state security, the VCK, was created, those people were mainly communists, and they believed in communism. And again, the idea was to have world revolution. So it's the same idea to take control over the world. Well, starting with Europe, to be fair, right? Because the world revolution had to be started in Europe. And so this is a kind of transition or evolution of this world revolution, right? The idea of taking control of the world, starting with Europe, which Putin is trying to implement now to take control of Europe. There is a difference, of course. The Communist Party, was in charge of the state and in charge of the state security, known mainly those, yes, as KGB. And as we know, the Communist Party failed. And in 1991, the Soviet Union, was dissolved and disappeared from the map. But from the point of view of KGB, the only reason why communists failed, because they were limited in their moves by this communist ideology. And that's why the idea of KGB was to survive what they did. This was the only structure which survived the collapse of the Soviet Union in 91. Everything else was dead. To survive and to continue their activity without political control, without any political control. And then they succeeded in 2000. And historically speaking, this is a very short period of time from 91 to 2000. But in 9 years, they were in charge of a major world power, not forgetting the fact, major nuclear world power. And they were ruling this country without, since 2000, when Putin became president, without any political control. They're above everything. The political parties in Russia basically do not exist. They exist, but they do not fight for power. The army is under control of the state security. It's a frightening picture, because there is, this never happened in the world, never happened, when a state security would run a country. We were dealing with dictators, monarchs, political parties, juntas, but state security never ran the country. This is the first experience, and I have to say that the experience happened to be a very frightening one, because those people were, for generations, those people were trained to destroy and to kill. They were never trained to build and to create. And that's what we are seeing now. That's why we see this level of destruction in Ukraine, for example, because for them, to kill is a part of their nature. I mean, again, those people who were selected to work for KGB, they are very much different from us.
And going back to those origins, the roots, of course, the Bolsheviks, when they took over, even within socialist revolutionary circles, they were a small minority group, a terroristic group. And they were right from the start imbued with a deep sense of paranoia and a commitment to violence, weren't they? And do you see those qualities of paranoia, of being surrounded by enemies, has that really genetically transitioned all the way through from the Bolsheviks through to the operations of the KGB and now FSB?
This is very correct. The Bolsheviks, indeed, was an extreme minority group within a general spectrum of the Russian social democratic movement. And when they took power in October of 1917, no one seriously believed that they would be able to hold it, because it's true they did not have too many members. They did not really have support of the entire country. Russia was mainly an agricultural peasant country, not a working class, Germany kind of state. So no one really believes that they would be able to hold power. And they were probably right. And people like Lenin, people like Trotsky probably understood this way as well, that the only way to keep this power is to create this first state security structure, which simply saying would kill everybody who is against. And that's how it all started, and that's how it's all continued. And the state security became more and more and more powerful with years. At one point, of course, Stalin, you know, took definitely control over state security. This was not so in the first years of the Soviet power. They were fighting for political power quite independently. But then against Stalin, they lost. And until 1953, until Stalin died, basically, this was the Communist Party, which were in control of situation. And Communist Party, of course, he had this armed department of the Communist Party called the State Security. But from time to time, Communist Party, because it was afraid of the state security very much, you know, was destroying those people who were in charge of you know, NKVD, MVD. Those days, they were changing names very, very often. They really, this is even funnier. They needed that structure, but at the same time, they were so much afraid of it. They were constantly reforming it and rebuilding it. And every time they would do it, they would physically destroy the leadership of the state security. And indeed, we're talking about dozens of thousands of high-ranking state security officers who were executed, dozens of thousands over the years. And indeed, the state security lost as a result of these purges more than they lost from you know, counter-revolutionaries or dissidents or terrorists or even Nazis. No one killed as many state security officers as the Communist Party. That's why KGB actually was quite happy to see the collapse of the Communist Party, because again, after the collapse of the Communist Party, they, for the first time, you know, they received the opportunity to rule without any political control. But yes, this is the same system, same, very often same people, because they serve there for generations. Same methodology, everything is the same.
And are there any meaningful foundations or lineage that can be traced back to the Tsarist secret police? Because that infrastructure started to be created in the 1870s. As Russia started to industrialize, and of course political movements really took hold in that period. Is there anything in the machinery the Tsars created that transitioned, or are there any methodologies they used? For example, seeding agents amongst oppositionists and, you know, terrorist groups. Is there anything that the Bolsheviks learned from the Tsarist secret police?
Well, probably the idea was kind of the same. The idea was, of course, to have a secret police which would be monitoring revolutionary movement. This, by the way, is used by KGB very often. The same idea that it's maybe less important to destroy your opponent than to control him. And we see it very often that this KGB destroys only in those cases when they're not able to control. And this relates to both organizations and private individuals. Now, I have to say that this was not so under Stalin. Of course, Stalin simply was killing everybody. But since 1956, the new rules of the game were introduced. Since 1956, the Communist Party never executed a single high-ranking KGB officer. right of 56, including 1956. The last execution ended in 1956. There were executions, but after 1956, not a single one, I believe, was actually killed. So the rules of the game changed. And at the same time came an understanding that it's important to control and to infiltrate and to control is more important than just to destroy from day number one the structure. But if we go back to Tsarist Russia, it was not developed. Let's put it this way. Who knows what would happen if Russian Empire would, survive for 50 more years or 100 more years. But the system was very small. The system was undeveloped. It was not really rude or too rude, or it was not too cruel towards revolutionaries. They usually was sent a sentence for small terms. They usually would be exiled. Usually they would have no difficulties to escape from this exile. Again, the time was different, the state was different, except the idea that you should controls them, probably nothing else is common.
Now, when I was living in Russia in the 90s, I mean, what struck me was the lack of a class system. And obviously the experience of the Soviet Union, took apart any institution or any class that could present opposition to the regime. It did strike me at the time, and it's got more forceful since, that the only grouping in society that actually had some kind of class identity and, sort of protected its interests or had common interests, culture and methodology was the FSB or the KGB itself. And it's interesting that you say that there have been few executions really since the end of the Stalin era. I mean, do you think is it meaningful or useful at all to look at the FSB as a kind of class with class interests? And does it have its own kind of culture? Or is it more like a mafia grouping?
Well, it is a kind of mafia grouping, first of all, because it's secret and not everybody knows very often who belongs to this club or group or class or institution. Then, of course, they are as rude as mafia when they deal with treason inside its own structure. And this is probably common for both structures, mafias and KGB. But again, mafia never had the idea of taking control of another state. I mean, it's mainly speaking a local phenomena. In every country, mafia exists. And the basic idea of mafia, the basic goal of mafia, to get money, to collect money, to become rich. If it's easier to become rich being part of political structures or through controlling governments, or through controlling political leaders. Oh yes, of course, any mafia would do this. But when we talk about the FSB or KGB, this is different, especially now when we talk about the FSB, because now the FSB is in charge of the state, of entire state. They control everything. They control all money. They control the entire economy. They control political institutions. They control the army. But if this would be about money, this would be our smallest problem. Unfortunately, this is not about money. And we've seen it in 2014, for example, because in 2014, when Russia invaded Ukraine, ruble plunge 50%, and if economically speaking, financially speaking, this operation was uniquely unprofitable. So from financial point of view, if you really think about money, you shouldn't invade Crimea and Eastern Ukraine. The same is true, of course, about the war against Ukraine now. Economically speaking, it's a disaster for the Russian Federation. So if the Russian government, if Putin personally, would be a corrupt politician who would be interested in personal wealth, again, we would deal with this small problem, because then somehow we would find the way to accommodate his interests, at least. So far, we are not able to do this because he simply wants territories. Literally, it's a primitive approach, although it's a very traditional approach. Russia was a territorial empire. Prior to 1917, it continued to be territorial empire prior to 1991. Stalin, of course, made a lot of successful, from this point of view, attempts to take new territories, and the Soviet Union was increased in its territory during his years of ruling. And Russia, how to say, Russia kind of lived comfortably as an empire, with understanding that within this huge state, Russians are the main partner and all other nations are kind of second-degree citizens. And when the Soviet Union collapsed and those second-degree citizens became independent and created their own states, and some of them in many ways became more successful than Russia because they joined European Union, they joined NATO, they were traveling abroad very often, and mainly because geographically they were much closer to Europe, of course. Russians started to feel uncomfortable that they were left without empire. And Putin very cleverly used it and sold to Russians this idea that all this unhappiness which they have, all those problems which they have because the West does not allow Russia to exist as an empire. And he used this successfully in 2014, well, even in 2008 when he invaded Georgia to test the waters. Even this was accepted by majority of Russians. The 2014 Crimea invasion was definitely accepted and supported by majority of Russians. So in 2022, he started full-scale war with Ukraine, with the idea that Ukraine quickly would give up and Russian Federation would reunite with Ukraine, number one, Belarus, which was taken in realistically, practically taken by Putin in 2021, and would proceed very quickly to Moldova, where Russians are living in Transnistria, and where the Russian government since 2014 issued 220,000 Russian passports. And this was done, of course, in order to create the ground for the claim that in Moldova, Moldovians are conducting genocide against Russians. The same was said, of course, about Ukraine. The same was said in Georgia in 2008. So this is the old trick which they were planning to use. This was the plan. This was the plan to create what Putin promised, to create again the Soviet Union. About Putin was nostalgic. Yes, he claims that this was both his personal tragedy and a major geopolitical catastrophe for Russia. And from here, another claim was born after 24th of February that Russia is not able to exist without Ukraine. What is a ridiculous claim, Again, we could laugh at it, except that people are dying now in thousands because Putin made this ridiculous claim that he's invading Ukraine because Russia is not able to survive without it.
And of course, Russia, you know, would exist without Ukraine, but it can't be an empire without Ukraine. I think that's the distinction, isn't it?
Precisely, and this is the problem. And this is the problem. Russia would never become a normal country. And I do not really know what we would consider a normal country. But Russia would never become a normal European country unless it heals itself from this imperial idea.
And of
It's
course,
just not going to happen.
And of course, the group, as you say, that has taken over the main organs of power in the country, the FSB and the Siloviki class, it does have some similarity to certain mafia codes, and that is a kind of omerta. So if you betray the KGB, if you betray the FSB, as we tragically know with Alexander Litvinenko, the Skripals, and more recently, you know, we've seen people defect from Wagner group of mercenaries. They are treated in brutal and lethal ways. It's a, you know, if you join that group, you join for life, don't you?
That's true. And that's why you were mentioning that there existed a certain class. Well, I do not really know if the class is the perfect word. Maybe there are words which describe this structure better. But the main idea is that once you become a member of this structure, you are there for life. And this is so. I mean, that's precisely how this is. You cannot work for KGB and then leave this structure and become a teacher or an engineer. It just doesn't work this way. They could send you to work as a teacher. They could send you to work as an engineer. And then you will be so-called officer of active reserve, working as a teacher or working as an engineer or working as a president of Russia, as Vladimir Putin does. So this is the irony. He's president of Russia, but indeed, he is the officer of active reserve sent to work as president of Russia. And that's what we are dealing with.
And of course, that group of people, you know, it's been in existence and it's had brutal methods. But in the sort of 60s and 70s, a certain myth was cultivated, wasn't it? The myth of the sort of moral and brave Secret Service operative. And I'm thinking in particular of you know, films like 17 Days of Spring, 17 Мгновений Весны, and such like. And it's this kind of mythology that probably inspired Putin and others to join that organization.
Well, these were brilliantly made films. We loved all of them very much, and all of us have seen them many, many times in the Soviet Union. And yes, I'm sure that a lot of people were moved by this movie, and a lot of people made decision to join the KGB because they were watching movies like this. But I have to say that this is probably is a poor explanation of the desires of young people to join the FSB, the KGB. They knew, of course, well, then this is not just a romantic movie story. They knew that with this they will have financial compensation, which is much higher than in civil sector. They will have support for life by this powerful organization. So I'm sure that those people who went there really knew what they were doing, especially because, to be fair, you couldn't join the KGB unless you already have high education. So we are not talking about 18 years old or 19 years old or 20 years old, young man or woman who you know is planning to serve the country and one who are naive to think that the best way to do this is through KGB. No, those people who came there, they were, you know, comparatively educated and experienced, not speaking about the fact that not everybody was taken by KGB. It's not that they would take everybody. They were very careful in selecting those whom they think should be serving for KGB. So and I'm sure that the department which selected, you know, potential officers knew what they were doing, because again, we basically do not see defectors, what means that the public relation office was personnel office was doing job quite professionally.
And you've talked about this group taking over the organs of power, and from the Soviet period, where there were multiple centers of power jostling and potentially competing, now there's only one that controls all the levers of power. And I think what people fail to understand is to what extent they control society. It's not just about controlling a limited opposition. It's about controlling every aspect of the state, isn't it? From the media to the parliament itself, in fact, organized crime merged with the secret services to an extent in the 90s. I was teaching at that point, and I got a sort of insight into how that was happening while working for a Finnish oil company, and lots of terrifying stories around that. But also the church, people have come to realize that actually the church is not a real organic organization. It's not separate from the state. It's entirely controlled, and indeed the patriarch, it's believed, was a former KGB agent. He was a KGB agent. He had an operative name, and in all likelihood is still part of that ruling group.
Well, that's precisely so. And again, you mentioned patriarch, but indeed the entire leadership of the Russian Orthodox Church basically was recruited by state security during the Soviet years, and this probably continues even now. And this is a major problem. We really do not know how many people work for KGB, how many people were working for KGB, or how many people work for the FSB. This information even now is unknown to us. Aside this, we of course do not know how many people are recruited as agents by KGB. We're dealing with major structure, and again, the idea with this institution to infiltrate everything and all major components of the society, all major political parties, all major institutions, all major newspapers, TV stations, you could name it. Everything is so much infiltrated. Russian Orthodox Church, of course, especially. Russian sportsmen organizations, again, those structures, those groups, those professions where people travel abroad, meet foreigners, talk to foreigners. Everything is so much infiltrated that it doesn't really leave uncontrollable spots. And that's why the structure is very powerful, because they are really in control. They are really in control. They do not need to kill people anymore, because they control everything. And they kill, to be fair, they kill very rarely, only, I would say, in three cases. One, which you already mentioned, when somebody from within the group conducts from their point of view treason, and this is the case of Litvinenko, and this is a case of Skripal. All the Skripal actually was arrested and then exchanged, and it was a breaking the rules story when they poisoned a former spy who already served some time and was exchanged by the Russian government. The second case, when people compete for power, but for high power with Kremlin or personally with Putin. And this is a case of Boris Nemtsov, for example, who was, planning to become next president if something happens to Putin. And the third case, of course, is when big money is involved, and then the rules are completely different. And for this, the KGB kills many people very often. And for example, those deaths within the community of Gazprom, when some managers were found dead together with their families, and usually brought, this probably was one of those cases when people were killed because of money.
It also implies, I think, quite a sort of interesting and an extremely sort of negative dynamic in society, because if everything is controlled, it means that you can't come up through society in any profession, in any sphere of life, organically, from the bottom up, through your own merit, through your own intelligence and efforts. It creates a system where patronage and nepotism, as well as, a willingness to agree to be part of that state system, it doesn't, I believe, encourage a kind of meritocratic society. It encourages kind of inertia and a lot of, let's say, talentless people rising up in society, when actually a lot of talented people become excluded from that system.
Precisely, and that's why you see this huge immigration of Russian specialists over these years. Those people who are not able, for one another person, reason to, fight for themselves the right place, they leave the country. Now, this is a catch-22 problem. You could, of course, leave those borders open, and then everybody who is unhappy for one another reason would emigrate. Or you could close this border, but then you are risking to have an explosion, and because all those people who are unhappy with the regime would be forced to be inside. And I think what the difference is between the main difference between the Soviet Union and the current Russian Federation is the Soviet Union existed with closed borders and without market economy, and Russian Federation exists with open borders and with market economy. And and this allows Putin actually to have less population, but more controllable crowd, because only those people who are ready to be controlled and who are ready to follow the government and who are not ready to oppose the government, only those are living in Russia, especially now after these two last immigration waves or points. First, of course, was 24th of February 22, when a lot of people who were afraid, number one, that Putin plans to close the border, and number two, that the war started and Putin probably would try to mobilize people, they left after 24th of February. And then, of course, on 21st of September, the moment Putin finished his famous speech about mobilization, where he announced mobilization of 300,000 young people, those 300,000 young people, by the time he finished his speech, already left the country. And again, this would be a laughing story except that this is really a tragedy. But this tells us a lot about Russia, because in any, again, quote unquote, normal country, if the president or prime minister would give this kind of speech, probably by the next morning, the crowd would run out of the houses to take down this government. In Russia, the crowd run out of their houses to escape from the country. And this is the difference between, because people in Russia do not really believe in possibility to change the government, to take it down, to reform it, because there are no elections in Russia for many years. There is no freedom of speech. There is no freedom of press. And I guess people were kind of ready to live like this until the moment when it touched them personally, until they received, you know, a note from a military department that they are obliged to go to the army tomorrow to fight in Ukraine. And again, it's not that they are against the war in Ukraine, but they just do not want personally to die for it. Again, this tells us a lot about Russia, but that's how it is. But it also tells us a lot about the government, because Putin doesn't really care how many people are killed. He doesn't care how many people are leaving the country. He does not care how many people are killed. He publicly announced recently at Valdai conference that the training continues for like 5 days or a week or maybe 2 weeks, and then they send those soldiers to the front. And they're dying, of course, by thousands. That's what the problem is, right? Again, it could be just a ridiculous story, except that we are having a major war in Europe because of this, and we are constantly living now under the threat or blackmail or bluff of nuclear confrontation. And this is all, again, because Putin wants to have an empire which Russia does not need. No one needs empires anymore. It's all gone. I mean, there was a period in the history of the world when states existed as empires, but this spirit is gone. It's a different world now. And Putin wants to return everybody to like whatever 19th century, sincerely thinking that this is the only way for Russia to survive.
And I mean, I was going to ask, you know, how do you take this group that is so deeply ingrained in a society, and how do you oppose it and root it out? But I think we already know the answer, don't we? Because Ukraine has shown how you can start that process. You have multiple revolutions. And as soon as you see a government becoming more tyrannical, as soon as you see a government starting to mold the system, whether it be oligarchy or the voting system, to perpetuate itself, you go on the streets and you drive it out. So we know what to do. And I think that's what terrifies Putin, isn't it? Is seeing that there's potentially a template, Change Russia, right there with these, what in his view, as you mentioned earlier, second-class culture, second-class country, a vassal country, and yet, you know, they're able to break out of that Soviet mold.
But that's where for Putin as a problem is, of course, because he didn't allow Ukraine exist as an example of basically a Russian-speaking state, because like 50% of Ukrainians were speaking Russian prior to 2022 war. This, of course, will change now. Now even Russians do not want to speak Russian in Ukraine. So not speaking about Ukrainians who do not want now to speak Russian. So this is, again, a kind of irony, because the intentions, whatever Putin had in his mind, bring absolutely opposite result. He invaded Ukraine, so you know Ukrainians would start to speak Russian, but they are refusing to speak Russian by the entire country now. He invaded Ukraine because he was afraid that Ukraine would join NATO and NATO would move closely to Russian borders. Now Finland and Sweden, who were never planned to join NATO, are becoming members of NATO. You know, he wanted Russia to be respected. No one respects Russia anymore at all. And Russians actually feel uncomfortable abroad now. So whatever he was attempting to achieve brought completely opposite results. But the problem is that after 8 months of war, Putin actually did not change the agenda and political program and the goal. What changed that now he has no army, and the only weapon which he has is the nuclear weapon. And that's why we hear from all levels of the Russian government that they are actually thinking to use it, because they kind of has nothing else to do, because they still are not ready to accept the fact that they were won on philosophical level, on political level, on military level, that they should accept the defeat, that they should accept the fact that they are not really great Russians. They are just ordinary Russians, just an ordinary country, and they should exist as an ordinary country, not as an empire. So that's again what the problem is. Until and unless Putin, and when I say Putin, I actually mean collective Putin from the FSB, accept the fact that Russia is not special, that this is just, you know, normal Russia, ordinary state, just a big one. Just a big one. Nothing healthy would happen to in Russia. Now, I think with months of war, Putin's position, of course, became much and much weaker. I think if we look at Putin in February 22, and if we look at him now, we understand that this is a different politician. No one actually wants to talk to him now. No one wants to negotiate with him now. No one is ready to sit at the common table with him now. No one is ready to shake his hand now. And he's absolutely powerless, because a small Eastern European country, Ukraine, about which Putin wrote a major article that this country doesn't exist, and these people do not exist, and this language doesn't exist, and they do not have the right to exist on the map, destroy the Russian army, like 200,000 hold, what strong the Russian army is. This was destroyed by Ukraine, and there is nothing what Putin could do. And indeed, Ukrainians are doing this under very difficult circumstances. It's true they are getting financial support and military support from the West. This is correct, absolutely. But they're not getting enough support. And they are getting this support on the condition that they're not using these weapons against territory of the Russian Federation and Belarus. And this is a very interesting limitation, because if you think from military point of view, it's impossible to win the war if you are not allowed to fire into territory of your enemy. It's even theoretically impossible. So that's why Ukrainians could hold the advance and sometimes push Russians out of some cities or regions, as we've seen with the Kharkov, advance of the Ukrainian army, and recently in Kerch, but they're not actually able to push Russians completely out of their own territory. Because Russians are, firing from Belarus and firing from Russia, and there is nothing what Ukrainians could do because they're not allowed to fire in return because the West is afraid to provoke a major war if Ukrainians fire into Belarus or into the Russian Federation. So this probably will change, I have to say, with time. I'm sure that the position of the Western, collective Western,
and especially
government
after this week,
right? Probably, especially after this week, and unfortunately, this is probably the first time, but I'm sure this is not the last time when a Russian missile lands somewhere else. But this probably will change in time with time, and I do understand that the West is afraid to widen this conflict and wants to do everything to keep this conflict within Ukrainian borders. But ironically, the way to keep this conflict within Ukrainian borders is to help Ukraine to push Russians out of Ukraine. Otherwise, this war will spread, as we've seen recently.
And of course, to collapse the Lukashenko regime would be another smart strategy to undermine Putin. But again, that's off the table. Potentially, assassination or coup, and supporting that in Belarus.
Well, this is an interesting point and a very important one. And again, to change regime in Belarus, you do not actually need to do too much because Lukashenko is a classical dictator. And if you give Ukrainians free hands to deal with him, they probably would be able to deal with him because, again, in Belarus, this comparatively small state, Lukashenko is a dictator. We've seen in 2020 that when he lost elections, the entire, it seems to be, the entire country went to protest. He suppressed it very much with the help of Russian police force, which was sent from Russia to Belarus. But there is actually a government in exile formed in Belarus. There are very important and serious political leaders sitting in prison there. Lukashenko puts them in prison. There is an army unit it's not really a division, but a brigade of Belarus forces, which is fighting in Ukraine against Russians. And not speaking about the fact that Belarus is strategically very important territory because this would allow Russia to attack with ground forces into eastern Ukraine. And not mentioning the fact that Putin is keeping Belarus independent formally, because I think he has this idea that if he decides to use nuclear weapons, he would fire not from the territory of the Russian Federation, but from the territory of Belarus. So the retaliation, whatever this is, would go against Lukashenko and not against him. So for this reason, I would say that it would be very important and very clever to deal with Belarus. And I always was thinking that the liberation of Germany in 1945 or by 1945 actually started with British and American troops landing in France, not in Germany, landing in Italy, not in Germany, landing in Greece, not in Germany. And Germany came only later. And the same might be said about Belarus case.
I mean, if we're being strategic, we would probably encourage Georgia to throw Russian troops out, and Moldova to do the same with Transnistria. But I think, as you say, the gloves are not off at this point. And Biden and the collective West are afraid to escalate. I've also heard a rather cynical military analyst suggest that attrition may also be behind this strategy, which is rationing the supply of weapons to purposefully grind Russia down and destroy it. I mean, that would be particularly cynical if that was the case, but I have heard that opinion aired.
Well, you see, if Russia is defeated in this war, and of course it's a good question of what we would consider defeated Russia in this war. But I would say that defeated Russia in this war is a Russia which accepted the fact that it lost the war. So far, it doesn't accept this. So far, the rhetoric changed, and Putin is saying that, well, we were planning to have a quick victory over Ukraine. We do not have it. But the reason why we do not have it is not because we are fighting against Ukraine. We will, you know, finish the war with Ukraine in 2 weeks. It's because we are fighting against the entire NATO. That's why we are not successful. And this, of course, changed completely the rhetoric, because if you are fighting against NATO, then, well, you probably should call it a war, and you probably should start to think about using nuclear weapons, because you're fighting against NATO. But if Russia is defeated, nevertheless, and I think it will be defeated, it's just a question of when and at what price, we will see many territories, you know, to separate from Russia, and we will see a lot of changes on the map. And of course, Georgia probably would try to take control again over those republics which it lost to Russian control in 2008. We, of course, are talking about Ukrainian borders of 2013. We are talking about probably Chechnya and Ingushetia and Dagestan separating from the Russian Federation. Probably Tatarstan. We probably would talk about, well, some kind of changing of status of Kaliningrad region, because Russia was using this for the blackmail, saying that, you know, from Kaliningrad nuclear weapons would fly to London very quickly, etc. So we will see a lot of changes, and but yes, they will come as a result of the defeat of the Russian Federation. You know, Japan probably will get back finally those Kuril Islands which Stalin took from Japan after the Second World War. This will happen. The question is when, because again, Putin is not ready to stop. Putin is not ready to turn back. Putin is not ready to accept the fact that he is losing the war, and is going to continue.
And my last question is, if Putin is an agent of the FSB on assignment as president of the country, is it possible that the group that coronated him, that put him in that position, is it possible that they may substitute him for somebody who will be a little more amenable to working with the West and allow them to build up their power, influence, and wealth again?
I think now it is possible after he is unsuccessfully trying to fight in Ukraine for more than 8 months, almost 9 months. Now, after he lost, towns, cities like Kherson, after he is not able to mobilize Russian army, and what is very important, after it became obvious that his strategy of frightening the West with a war or a nuclear war doesn't really work. And what I'm slightly afraid of that what we might witness in very soon is the attempt of the FSB to take down the entire group, which is well known to the entire world now, and this is Mr. Putin, Mr. Prigozhin, Mr. Shoigu, probably Lavrov, etc., are replacing them with new people and pretending that this is creating a platform for negotiations, at the same time hoping basically to hold the same positions. What we need to see, and I honestly have to say that I do not think that this is going to happen unless Russia is defeated, but we have to see people who would be ready in the beginning of the first stage of these negotiations to stop the war, to move out troops, to recognize the borders of 2013, and to accept the in principle of the readiness to pay compensation to Ukraine. Although on practical level, honestly, I even do not know what we are talking about, but let's say in principle. And then I think we should also expect some known war criminals to be sent for tribunal in Hague. That's how it's all should start. But we probably should talk also about Russian troops moving out of Transnistria, about recognition of 2008 or pre 2008 war borders for Georgia. That's what we should expect from those new faces or new members of the government if Putin has changed. And again, I do not believe that those people, his colleagues from the FSB, are ready to do this, even in exchange for the survival of their institution. But this probably what they're thinking about, that they should find the way to survive, because they were good in surviving since December of 1917. They were good in surviving. They survived every time. In 1956, when Khrushchev conducted destalinization, in 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, they survived every time. And they, of course, hope to survive now as well, because that's what's important for them, because they know that if they survive, they will find the way to rule again.
And they're following a historic pattern that needs to change, aren't they? Which is imposing a system from above, a top-down approach to trying to coerce Russia into being a particular entity, to coerce people out of their sort of apathy and inertia. What Russia needs is a bottom-up set of reforms rather than the top-down, because Peter the Great, Lenin, everyone's tried the top-down approach, and it clearly has only resulted in empire and misery.
I sincerely think that if we find a way, what is difficult, and I really do not know how to do this or how to do this quickly, if somehow we dissolve the FSB without the right for this organization to be recreated or reborn again, then everything else would be a matter of, small difficulties. I think this is one and the only problem of Russia, which existed, which always existed, which we missed in 1991 because no one paid attention to KGB. And that's, again, this was intentionally promoted by KGB as well, right? By itself, by the structure itself. But I think this is the major problem which exists in Russia. And if you find the way to deal with the structure and dissolve it, everything else will follow.
And I think, Yuri, that's where we'll end it on. And that's why the work you're doing, the books that you're writing are so incredibly important to help people's understanding of that. We're going to put links to your books in the description of this video. And I highly recommend people read those to gain a much better understanding of why we're in the current situation. But I really want to thank you for your precious time that you've given to this and for the absolutely enlightening conversation.
Thank you very much for your time.